Family. Imagine yourself at 9 years old. Picture your world. Your parents or lack of parents. Your siblings. Your home or lack of home. Did you feel safe? Noticed? Did you have to make your own way? Or were you nurtured? As I said before, this season in our lives, between 8 and 10 years old, is when the self turns on like a light. How you saw the world then is how you will likely see it for the rest of your life. It's the original coding on which all your other memories sit. You figured out how to be okay, how to behave in order to feel safe. An example. At 9 years old, I lived with a wonderful mother and a distant stepdad. I had a fun father and a stepmom who I saw on weekends. My dad and stepmom had an infant daughter, my little half-sister. She was cute and innocent of all the family complexities of divorce. But the three kids my parents had while they were together, we were different. There was me, my older sister, the wild one, and my little brother, who was always dealing with medical issues. I saw how taking care of them devoured my mom's time and energy. I loved her, and she loved me, but she had her hands full. So I decided to need nothing. I aimed to become good and invisible. I'd get good grades and play in the woods and do my own thing. This compulsion to be independent and not disturb anyone worked its way into the core of my personality. To this day, I won't let anyone go to the doctor with me when I'm sick. I can't ask a favor. I'll do it on my own. And I'll be strong, never needy, never cumbersome. In romantic relationships, I don't think to ask for more affection or better communication. The thought that I could be worthy of asking for something, of feeling things, founded or unfounded, and speaking them, is so far removed from my consciousness. That I could be hurting and ask for help. Wow, even typing that is hard. I cringe. There doesn't have to be a villain in a story like this. My parents loved and cared for me and gave me a fantastic childhood. Many kids are not nearly as lucky as I was. But you don't have to have shitty parents to inherit wrong thinking simply by circumstance. It's just the thorny way of life. This is everyone's story and everyone's duty. To reach adulthood and then do the hard work of unpacking your childhood, your family, the weapons you picked up to protect your little body. On the journey of growing up, there are casualties. That 9-year-old kid is trying to survive. And if you had siblings, you may have stepped on a few necks to save yours. You may have said a mean word to feel in control. You may have hit or pushed someone to learn the impact of force. You're finding yourself, and you don't know what you don't know. It is hard to admit that you leave a wake behind you. It is hard to admit that you may indeed be someone else's villain. I was horrible to my little brother, Luke. I tortured him. I enjoyed it. When I learned he was claustrophobic, I started sneaking up behind him with our giant beanbag chair and leaping on top of him. I was twice his size. He would scream a real horror movie scream, and it thrilled me. I loved to hear him scream. Sure, I knew I wasn't actually hurting him. And that was part of the pleasure, that he was afraid for no reason, that he sounded ridiculous. I loved the psychological terrorism. Luke was never mean to me. He was and is pure kindness. He would come to watch television with me in the living room, and I would yell at him to get out. He would try playing Nintendo with me, and I would shake with rage. I would walk in on him playing video games and proclaim, "You have 5 minutes, and then it's my turn." We shared a room until I was about 11 or 12. I hated sharing with him. I got a roll of duct tape and made a barrier down the center of the room. I even stood on a chair and made it wrap all the way around the ceiling. "This is my side of the room and that is yours. You do not ever come on my side. None of your toys or things can touch my side." "But the door to the room is on your side. How do I get out?" "Through the window," I said. I remember, even at that young age, wondering why I hated him so much. In my calmer, alone moments, I didn't hate him. It was only when I saw him that the impulse came alive. My mom would referee our fights. "When y'all grow up, you'll be friends," she would say. "You'll love each other. That's how it always happens." We ignored her as we punched and clawed. Him always in self-defense. I'm sure he started it once in a while, but I know it was only a response to my brutality. A chance to feel agency on his part for once. In his early teens, Luke developed a stutter. His words stopped and started, and he struggled to finish sentences. I didn't think much of it. It occurred to me much later that the stutter might have been a response to me mocking him every time he opened his mouth. In high school, we were a bit better. We fought less. We had our own rooms and went to different high schools. He had medical needs and had to go to a school with more individualized attention. Then one day, he said offhandedly, "I'm going to kill you when you turn 32. I laughed. He laughed. "To pay you back for torturing me my whole life," he added. I don't know why he chose 32, but I remember thinking, if he does kill me, I probably deserve it. I thought about that promise over the years. As I went off to college and lived my life, I would stop every so often and wonder if my bullying had metastasized into a hidden hatred in him. Years later, when I turned 32, Luke didn't kill me. We had become friendly in adulthood and hadn't fought in years. He'd married a beautiful woman, bought a nice house, had a good job. He had friends and a pool, and things looked good. I had just come home from living in South America for a year. I was 2 years older than Luke, and the only thing I owned was a laptop. I had a birthday party and Christmas with the family. My birthday falls right before Christmas. And sure enough, he didn't murder me that day. Throughout my 32nd year, I wondered a few times if it would come. It wasn't that I thought he was violent. It was that I thought I might deserve it. I've had only one recurring dream in my life. It first came to me when I was in high school. In it, I am hiking with my brother through a forest. We are friends in the dream. He steps over a log, and just as I'm about to step behind him, I see a huge snake about to strike at him. I push Luke out of the way, and as I do, the snake misses him and hits me square in the back. I feel its fangs enter me, feel the venom flow through my limbs. And while I writhe on the ground in pain, my brother stands over me, blank-faced. "Luke, go get help," I say. And he replies, disinterestedly, "Help yourself," before walking away. They say you can't die in a dream, that you'll wake up just before you do. That is not true. Each time I've had this dream, I die. I feel my consciousness slip away, and then nothing. I thought about that dream last year when I did a multi-day therapy workshop outside of Nashville. It's called OnSite. They specialize in trauma and mental health. The workshop is hard to explain, but it's kind of like a retreat mixed with therapy and horses and incredible meals. I did it right before my first book came out. No phones, no booze or cigarettes or even exercise. Nothing you can use to escape how you feel. This is where I heard about the theory from the beginning of this section, about how your world at 9 years old can define the person you become. The workshop is meant to help people get their inner lives in order so that they can thrive in their outer ones. It isn't woo-woo or New Age. It's science and psychology and summer camp. I did it with about 20 other people. OnSite specializes in experiential therapy. It isn't simply talk therapy, which is what most of us think when we hear therapy. In this program, they do group exercises. You're in multi-hour sessions every day with the same group of people and two therapists guiding you. The main part of your work involves recreating your childhoods using one another as metaphorical stand-ins. If it was my turn, for example, the therapist would ask me to create my family in the center of the room. Someone played my mom, someone else played my dad, my sister, my stepdad, my brother. Then I would walk around the circle and explain the dynamic between each character. The therapist asked, "What did you need to hear from your mother?" She asked me to stand in my mother's place and say it. Then, the person playing my mother would step back into place and speak those words to me. This can sound silly, but therapists have discovered that putting the conversation into space, giving it shape and size and movement, reaches more parts of the brain than we normally access. It isn't just talking and internal narrative. It's hearing words come from someone else. It's standing next to someone. It's hugging. Your brain doesn't think only in words. It thinks in feelings and spatial structures too. It comprehends distance and tone. And most important, it grasps concepts through metaphor. The brain understands best when it can map reality into a simile. By replaying and reenacting an experience, having a conversation that you needed to hear but one that never happened, you reach deeper into your subconscious, into the frightened lizard brain, and from there, begin healing it. This kind of work is used to uncover trauma or shame or fear stored in the old core of the brain. This is the part of the brain that evolved before our consciousness to help us survive, to jump at a snake or gasp at a bear. If it doesn't do its job, all our pontificating about solar systems and critical race theory are worthless. Traumatic memories sit in that part of the brain forever, until we deal with them, until we heal them through proper grieving. In my final session of the workshop, after we'd laid the groundwork of my family's structure and dynamics, I was asked, "What is something you want to work on? What is a place of shame for you?" And I knew immediately what I wanted to do. It surprised me because I hadn't thought about it in years. But it was an example of that moment when you know the thing you're afraid to say is exactly what you should say. I didn't want to pull it into the light because it would force me to look at a side of myself that I feared. I told my therapist that I wanted to recreate my teenage years, to work on something that brought me shame and pain. "What age?" she asked. "Probably 13 or 14 years old." "Okay, build your family as it was then." So I had people in the group play my mother, stepdad, and sister. And I asked my friend Danica to play my brother, Luke. The therapist then had me speak as my brother, telling me what he needed when we were teenagers and what his experience was. I stepped in his shoes and spoke to me. "I only ever loved you, and you hated me. I was only ever nice to you, and you hated me. You gave me a stutter. You hurt me." An enlightened defense leapt to my mind as I stood there. "I hated you because you kept Mom's attention. You were cute and everyone thought you were so adorable. No one said anything to me. I was invisible because of you. I hated you because you took my mother away from me." His response came to me as well. "I had serious health problems. I didn't want to take attention from you. You were the smart one who got good grades and was a star everywhere we went. You wouldn't have died. I actually could have died." The simple act of having someone stand before me, holding space for my brother, speaking words I couldn't hear or didn't have the bravery to confront, it unlocked something. I pictured the ingredients of trauma, how in my childlike insecurity and self-protectionism, I was likely a source of trauma for my brother, building deep wounds in the foundation of who he is. I began sobbing. My friend Danica stood in front of me, looking up with eyes bursting with empathy as I begged for forgiveness. I was facing the scary truth at my core, that perhaps I am mean and cruel. I, at my core, am rotten. After that experience, Danica de-rolled. She put her hands on my shoulders and said, "I am not your brother. I am Danica." This is a formality that helps the emotional brain disconnect the fire of what just happened from the person standing in that role. Everyone hugged me and encouraged me to write Luke a letter, to tell him that I was sorry. Even if I thought he was over it, clearly I wasn't. If only to heal me, and perhaps to heal him. Because in the end, it was him who received the cruelty. Yes, the perpetrator suffers the rot and often ends up spiritually worse, but that doesn't make them the victim. I planned to write the letter, but I didn't. I left the workshop and slipped back into my life. I saw my brother at dinner at our mom's house and hugged him and complimented his shirt and freshly washed truck. I asked him how everything was. I was a bit over the top with the niceties, but I didn't write the letter. I was just a kid when I tormented Luke. He was a kid, and he had turned out wonderful and fine. No harm, no foul. My masculine fear of sentimentality worked against me. It froze me. 8 months later, we had a sibling dinner. This is a tradition my sister started, where the four of us get together and drink wine and eat and read passages from books and have singing competitions and do accents and smoke cigarettes. No parents allowed. We're adults now and live in different parts of the country, and it's not easy to see one another. It's also hard to overcome the strange aversion to awkwardness that is so common in families. The effortless banter of friendship vanishes with family. We have trouble talking about anything serious or encouraging one another. Sibling dinner was my older sister's attempt to overcome that. Whenever I'm home from California, she cooks and invites us all over, me, my brother, and our younger sister, and sets conversation topics. At this most recent one, my sister asked a grenade of a question. After food and enough wine to loosen our tongues, she sat us around the patio table, lit up a cigarette, and asked, "What is one thing you most regret?" My immediate response was to take the philosopher's position. "I don't really have regrets. Life is full of lessons, and each one got me here. So here I am. To remove any action from the past would rob me of the growth today." But there was my little brother, sitting across from me. He had his hand on his lovely wife's knee. A thought poked up like a whack-a-mole in the center of my brain. "You regret how you treated Luke. You regret how cruel you were. Say it, you coward motherfucker." "I regret how I didn't try in school. I was so afraid of failure. I'd rather take B's than try for A's and fail," I said. My siblings nodded and then took turns sharing. They said some sweet things. Nothing shocking. I felt relieved that the exercise had gone past me, and also pathetic for not taking this opportunity to say the right thing, to apologize. That lazy, idiot teenager inside of me had taken the wheel. Then it was Rebecca's turn. Only she didn't share a regret. She skipped right over herself and looked at me. "Okay, say something else. Let's do another round." "But you didn't go," I said. "I'll go at the end. This is my house. Go again." Shit. My mother's voice came to my mind. All the times she had encouraged me to write my brother a kind note, or to call him, or to tell him how impressed and proud I was of him. It all felt so contrived and silly. She even said once that I should actively reconcile with Luke. I remember saying, "Mom, what are you talking about? He has a great life now, and I'm off in California. He doesn't care about that stuff." "I bet it would mean a lot to him," she said. Some small thing inside me wondered if he had talked to her about it, if he had expressed adult hurt. Another memory leapt to mind. For years, I would refer to my brother only as Puke. It was a funny distortion of his name, taking the piss out of each other like brothers do. When he was 25 and I was 27, I called him Puke at some point over Christmas, and he snapped. "I'm 25 years old," he said. "You can't call me Puke anymore. Please stop." I was stunned. I'd never heard him speak like that, like a man, with boundaries. Embarrassed and immediately joking, gaslighting him probably, I said, "Oh, wow, okay. Didn't know it was such a big deal." But I never called him that again. This all flashed in my brain in seconds, as if some bigger truth I'd been covering was sitting in the room, suddenly visible. Rebecca was staring at me, waiting for me to speak. I wondered if Mom had put her up to this. "I guess, well, I do regret the way I treated Luke," I said. I was talking to Rebecca, not to Luke. Luke's wife, Anna, suddenly sat up, leaned in to listen to me, utterly absorbed. "I was so mean and cruel, and he was only ever loving and nice to me, and that wasn't right. If I could do it all over again," I looked directly at Luke, "I'd be a good brother to you." Anna's eyes had tears in them, which shook me. Luke was looking at the ground. "That's all I needed to hear," he said. Anna was rubbing her husband's leg. "I wondered if this would ever happen. I'm so happy I could cry," she said, tears coming out of her smiling eyes. A wave of hot shame poured from my cheeks, shame at realizing how much pain my brother still carried, how he must have talked about this with Anna many times, how they'd lived with me, the villain in their story, all these years, and yet they still loved me. Now I'd finally said something, a shitty little apology, and it lifted a foot-thick blanket of ash that had covered us for 2 decades. "Luke, I am so sorry. I love you. You're an amazing man, in spite of how shitty I treated you. I love you so much." "That's all I needed to hear," he said, glancing at me but mostly looking away, his head nodding at nothing. "That's all I needed to hear." When I come home for the holidays, I stay at my mom's house, the house I grew up in. She puts out her seasonal decorations and tidies my old room. She washes the dogs. She plans a family dinner. She walks me into the dining room to show me the play settings. She wants to say, "I love you more than anything, and I would do anything for you, and I wish you would move back to Nashville, and I'd love to see you every day and hear all that you're doing and be best friends, and we should write together and plan some trips in the motorhome, and I'm getting older and time is precious and I'm so proud of you, and I don't want anything to be unsaid." But she knows if she said all of that, I would shut off. I would get quiet, freeze up, and make an excuse about having to go work at a coffee shop. I still have that teenage instinct to leave the nest when I'm around her, to receive my mother's affection and attachment as fuel to leave. I can't help it. I hate that I can't help it. She wants to watch me eat the breakfast she made me. She wants to say all the things in the world, but she can't. So she asks, "Do you have any laundry you need me to do?" I want to say, "You are the best mom that has ever lived. You have made me who I am. You are clever and kind and true and generous and a living example of the type of person I want to be." But I don't say that. I say, "No, Mom, I'm all good." "Well, okay," she says. She pauses, trying to think of some other way she can serve me. "Let me know when you do." "Mom, I know you'll read this. This is me telling you, putting it in print, in my cowardly, masculine, roundabout way." I'm going to paraphrase something I read somewhere. Was it on Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, Reddit, a group text? This is the trouble with too much information from too many sources coming from that little glowing screen in your hand. Imagine you're a parent, and your kid is always playing video games in their room. You give them grief about it. You tell them they never socialize and that they are being rude and disrespectful. You have family over, and finally the kid comes out to engage. You say, "Oh, look who it is. The old hermit makes a rare appearance. Thank you for gracing us with your presence." Your voice drips with sarcasm. You make fun of your kid in front of the family. The kid feels like shit, called out. If I was them, I'd go right back to my room. Why do we punish people for finally doing the thing we wished they'd do, for making steps in the right direction? When I spend time with family, I'm reminded of the ever-present ghost of the unsaid, the hardened hearts, the brothers who no longer speak, the life choices whispered and worried about in private. It is remarkable how hard it is for families to talk about things, to shine sunlight on the wounds in the basement. I also see this in spouses. Tiny cuts accumulate into a tone of annoyance that colors their every conversation. It's the grown-up version of pinching your little brother in the back seat and telling mom that nothing happened. "She won't even let me near a motorcycle." "That's not what I said." They litigate their conversations in front of you, trying to shame each other in front of an audience. Contrast this with the way we treat our friends. We listen. We share our every thought. We take in new information and give our best. We light up with attention and care. We are hard to offend. Something in us wants to be chosen, not bought. A bird on a branch, not a rooted tree. But when all goes to hell, those unbreakable bonds, those people tethered to you by history or covenant, they are often the ones who save your life, who provide a ground zero. They are home. I wonder what it takes to give our bright shining best to those we're bound to treat our family like friends, to overpower the instinct to retract and avoid. I don't know. I seem to enjoy sealing myself, closing myself off from showing that kindness. I keep doing it. The head has trouble overriding whatever wiring makes me want to run. I'm grateful to my parents for instilling in me the desire to open doors, to follow the creek upstream, to turn down windy roads that take too long, to turn over rocks and look for snakes, to value wisdom and experience over the conventions of our assembly line society. I was terribly strange as a child. I was obsessed with dinosaurs, daytime talk shows, and writing moody songs on the piano in the dark. I would dip G.I. Joes in nail polish remover and light them on fire in the backyard. My poor parents. Yet they never asked me to be anything but myself. In sixth grade, my mom lied to the school office and told them I had a doctor's appointment. She picked me up at lunch and took me to see the re-release of Star Wars on opening day. I thought heaven had come to earth. Growing up, I realized I was immune to poison ivy. I think I knew my little brother was not. I went up to him and said, "Hey, look what I can do," and rubbed the poison leaves all over my face. "I can do that too," he said, as any younger brother would. And he rubbed and rubbed. He had to go to the hospital because his face swelled up like a red beanbag. His eyes sealed shut. I got in big trouble. One time I was sitting in my room drawing dinosaurs when my sister knocked on my door. I opened the door and there she was, with her evil best friend Dee Dee. They had an aerosol can and a lighter. Before I could react, they blew a giant ball of fire in my face. I screamed. I hit a Mariah Carey note. I was so furious, I shouted, "Burn in hell," to them. It's the only time I've ever really cursed someone. In retaliation, I snuck into my sister's room that night and unplugged everything. I unscrewed the light bulbs. Then I called the house phone, knowing she'd pick up in her room. I disguised my voice to sound like a stranger. I said I was stalking her and had turned off the power in the house. She tried to turn her lamp on. It didn't work. She screamed bloody murder and locked herself in the bathroom for an hour. This is my confession, Rebecca. That was me. Kids do strange things, bad things. We test to see the consequences of our actions. We peacock and make power plays. We see what we can get away with. Adults do the same thing, I think. The testing is just more complex, more hurtful, harder to understand. Adultery, avoidance, secret lives, midlife crises. Growing up often looks like covering up. Do you remember that phase before middle school, before life revealed to you yourself and your body and the differences of others? When you were a creature of pure curiosity? When you still told your parents you loved them, and you were too pure to see in their faces that they knew you'd stop saying it soon? When your dad still picked you up? Do you remember the last time one of your parents picked you up and held you? There was a last time, and no one noticed. Remember when the creek at the bottom of the hill was all the adventure in the world? When you loved what you loved and gave two shits if anyone else did? For me, it was dinosaurs and comics and snakes and creatures in the creek. Remember those few years of utter clarity? When you were smart enough for language, but young enough for wonder? Where love was love and comparison was a foreign idea? My life seems to be a pendulum-like journey, searching for that feeling and grabbing it as I swing past, crumpling it up like a t-shirt that smells nice and pushing it into my face. I remember my dad saying, This guy I know didn't want to raise his kids out here in Spring Hill. He thought it was too rural. But I told him how my kids grew up out here and how the country made them imaginative. How my son Jed's favorite thing was going to the dump. Oh my gosh, I forgot, I said. My favorite days were when we'd go to the dump and I'd find stuff. We were too remote to have trash service. Every week or two, my dad would fill the bed of his truck with trash and broken tools, and we'd head out to the Murray County dump. He'd let me ride in the back sometimes with all the junk. When we pulled up, there would be giant metal containers with garbage divided by category: plastic, metal, paper. Inside these containers were discarded toys, magazines, treadmills, shiny metal things. I'd poke around with my dad calling from another container. Be careful now. Don't touch things that look sharp. I always found something. An old man's cane, a perfectly good G.I. Joe, a spark plug that could work as an alien cannon for my Ninja Turtles. I couldn't believe people would throw away such good stuff, but I was so glad they did. We'd finish up and head back to the farm, maybe stop on the way and get a Dr. Pepper. Dad would play Sting on the truck's cassette player, and I'd feel rich with my new things. I saw I, Tonya last year, the movie about the ice skater Tonya Harding. I remember being a kid when the news showed Nancy Kerrigan crying about her knee, and Tonya Harding was turned into a villain on skates. I've spent my entire life making Tonya Harding jokes. The movie is funny and strange and silly, but it also portrays another side of Harding. A girl raised without love. A girl mocked from the beginning. A girl who thought skating might be her ticket out of all that mess. And when things got hard, she made some pretty massive mistakes. The frightened girl, stunted by fear and self-defense, made choices like a frightened child. Maybe she's a heartless monster, an opportunist, a creep. Maybe she is beyond redemption. Maybe she's not. I think about poor kids who sell drugs or drop out of school. What if the only thing modeled for them was distrust? What if leaving the neighborhood was a form of betrayal? I am astonished that anyone overcomes their past. There is a saying, I'll screw it up, but it goes something like, if we could comprehend all, we would understand all. If we understood all, we would forgive all. I think it's more complicated than that. Even when we understand someone, their actions may still cause incredible harm, and the harm must be stopped. But it's also true that the method of stopping matters. Hatred, mockery, and caricature seem to embolden the wounded who continue to wound. How do people overcome? I doubt many people become better after being hated. Pride latches on to old positions, raises its voice, fights to the death. But I've seen kindness and understanding soften the fortress walls. When has mockery saved a soul? When has a shouting match ended in mutual elevation? When to be gentle and when to revolt? What is the way to lasting peace? Let me paint a picture. If your mom worked hard and planted many crops, and no calamities came to ruin her farm, you would grow up with a full belly. But if your mom had a farm and didn't work hard, or if a tornado or thief came and took everything, you would grow up hungry. Your mom would be ashamed or broken. In her brokenness, maybe she would hate you and herself. Either way, we don't earn our beginnings. You didn't earn a successful mother any more than another child earned an unsuccessful one. You, the well-fed child, would be strong and have enough leisure time to develop important skills, ones that would make you competitive. You would assume your childhood is what all other childhoods are like. You may meet the child of an unsuccessful mom on the playground and ask why their clothes are dirty. They would be ashamed. Now imagine this cycle being repeated over 10 generations. There is a paradox in our thinking. To believe that the efforts or misfortunes of our parents greatly determine our lives, while simultaneously believing that we come into life on equal footing and that our successes are ours to boast about. This dynamic seems responsible for the existential tension currently in the air, in our politics, and in the big societal problems that we can't seem to solve. We wake up into life profiting from, or disadvantaged by, the events of our ancestors. We're proud of some of the things, and we ignore others. Some of us stand on the shoulders of devils, slaveholders and crooks, profiting now, and do not even know. And yet here we are, responsible for our own lives, taking credit for our hard work and careers, blaming the junkie for his weakness, praising the entrepreneur for her work ethic, ignoring the puppeteers of history and consequence. I joke that God sometimes gets busy and doesn't have time to make each person unique. So he hits Control-C and makes copies. There are a few members of my family who seem this way. My Aunt Lily, my Aunt Abby, and me. We are soul copies. We prank call together. We put flowers down our shirts. We collapse the passing years with one loud cackle and clasping fingers at a joke. We are glad God was hurried. I don't believe in having children, a friend of mine said. I think it's wrong to bring a child into this world. What? Why? I said. If I could choose to not have been born, I would choose that. It's not worth it. Too much pain. Too much suffering. It feels like an injustice. That sent me for a spin. I love being alive. I testify to this every day. I find beauty in garbage and laughter in traffic. I wake up in love. Many people don't feel this way. When I wrote my first book, I thought about this a lot, about how my words would be misinterpreted, about how people who see the world differently from me might hate it, find it annoying, sentimental, and false, how I'd be accused of this motive or that, of being out of touch or privileged and blinded by it. I truly don't know what to do with the diversity of experiences in this life, except to offer kindness and speak when I can and listen when I should. One of my mentors often says, I don't judge others, tell people that they're wrong or I'm right. The truth works itself out. Life is an orchestra. I'm here to play my note. No one else's, and it's not my job to tell them how to play. I listen to their music, and maybe they listen to mine. I just want to make the music I'm supposed to make. What is expected of us when we disagree? What happens when you believe government should help and your brother thinks it should get out of the way? What happens when you believe God puts a human soul in a fertilized egg and your sister doesn't believe in souls and believes that a fetus is part of a woman's body until it can live on its own? What happens when you believe you were born a woman in a man's body? You believe it so deeply that you're willing to endure public ridicule and shame to be your true self, and your father thinks you're mentally ill. We know what usually happens. Relationships collapse, family members become strangers to one another, or enemies. The other is mocked, demonized, or prayed for. There's a place in Los Angeles called the Museum of Tolerance, and I always thought its name was so unfortunate. Tolerance? That's the best we can hope for? Why not the Museum of Acceptance, of love, of respect? As I've gotten older, though, I've seen how worldviews are not as malleable as I once thought. An argument is as effective as a light breeze. It can tip you over, but only if you're teetering or loose. Childhood and biology are the top influencers. Second to them, experience and relationship. Tolerance is not the same as acceptance. I don't want to accept a belief I think is wrong or hurtful or dangerous. That would betray my morals. But I believe in the dignity of human agency and the complexity of experience. I think we can have grace for one another and the strength to stand up for ourselves. That's tolerance. Sometimes that's the best we can do. That and the long, slow work of truth. Truth is a stubborn thing. It corrects, it rebukes, but most of all, it takes its time. Foolishness can spend centuries riding on the back of half-truth. How do we stay in relationship with one another? I've seen humor go a long way. Goodwill, the belief that people are trying their best, doing what they think is right. Start there. Seek understanding. It is much harder to hate a friend.